Thank you for downloading from Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Support for this podcast comes from your generous gifts and donations. You can find out more about Ravi Zacharias and the team at www.rzim.org.
Hello, friends. This is Ravi Zacharias. We're coming down to the end of our fiscal year, end of September. And what a year it's been. It's been one of the most extraordinary years that we have lived through. So many incredible opportunities, so many countries covered, with a team now of 47 full-time apologists or adjunct speakers or as well fellows covering the globe in about 15 countries. But one of the major projects we launched into in the beginning of this year was the Zacharias Institute, for which we had to put in so much of our efforts in order to generate the funding. As a result, oftentimes the Global Fund can be neglected. So we are coming to the fiscal year end here at RZIM, how much we really need your support and your encouragement. Let me just take you to one of them, in Nazareth, Israel. We had just driven from Bethlehem, where I had had a full house and a full slate of meetings, and we'd arrived in Nazareth. I checked into my hotel room just about an hour before the meeting. The place was packed with young people. That's so fascinating to see. And at the end of it, I was answering questions for so long. And a young man standing in the wings asked me if he could just speak to me. And he said, I want to speak to you alone because it's a very private matter. So we stepped out of the building, but a couple of my colleagues, not too sure whether I should be doing that because it was quite dark outside. We went into the shadows to talk, but two of my colleagues went about 15 yards of it just so that they could see, although they couldn't hear. And he shared with me his private story. I won't go into it. But he said, you know, I really need somebody to talk to. He said, you're like a father figure, struggling with suicide and one other issue. And as I looked into his eyes, albeit in the dark out there, I thought to myself, this is why we travel. This is why we are there. Some people will never talk on an email or on a phone. They really need to privately share what it is that's going on in their lives. And there I was with the ability to just put my hand on his shoulder, pray with him, and see him make that turn. So much has gone on, but we need your support so that we can balance our budget fiscal year ending September 30th, 2016. Would you ask the Lord what he would have you do, please? This is for a massive team in so many countries with so much going on. Your support, your generous gift for our global fund would be immensely valued. We are coming down to the end of the days now, and we really need for you to seek the Lord on what he would have you do. If we could cross this line truly in the black and every bill paid and every budget met, it would have been nothing short of a miracle. Thank you, and God bless you. This was the most bizarre perspective and counter-perspective balance that I have ever seen in a dialogical process. What the Wall Street Journal was thinking here, I have no idea, but at least to their credit, they are printing the letters to the editor that are demonstrating exactly what I'm saying to you, so I respect them for that.
Bizarre is a good way to describe an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal asking the question, where does evolution leave God? Hello and welcome to Let My People Think with author and apologist Ravi Zacharias. I'm Bob Dittmer, and Ravi is here to talk with us today about the logic behind that op-ed piece. The two writers that answered the question were Karen Armstrong and Richard Dawkins. Armstrong, the author of several books on comparative religion, said we need God to grasp the wonder of our existence. Dawkins, the well-known atheist, answered the question by saying, it left God with nothing to do. Well, Ravi, before we get into the specifics, let me ask you what you think of having those two offer counterpoints on that question.
You know, actually, to give it the kindest response, it would really have been something like this, Bob. It should have been called a dialogue between biological evolutionary theorists and theological evolutionary theorists, because Karen Armstrong believes that the belief in God is also an evolutionary process, what we used to believe, then what happened along the way with punctuated attacks, and so we sort of refined the belief of an idea of God rather than the God who never actually existed being now given a certainty. And for Richard Dawkins, of course, it's all matter, it's all material, it's all physics. And the interesting thing is, with Dawkins' idea that it's given God nothing to do, but it's given the atheists plenty to do, you know, and they are doing it with a lot of money involved in the process. So even the denial of God has provided a lot of grain in the mill for them, to so to speak. As I said in my response to the Wall Street Journal article, you know, it would be like asking Osama bin Laden's view on his thoughts of America and then asking Hugo Chavez for a second opinion. This was the most bizarre perspective and counter-perspective balance that I have ever seen in a dialogical process. What the Wall Street Journal was thinking here, I have no idea, but at least to their credit, they are printing the letters to the editor that are demonstrating exactly what I'm saying to you. So I respect them for that, that in effect they've said, you know, this is the response we've got to positioning Dawkins vis-a-vis Armstrong.
Let's talk about some of the things that they wrote in that essay. Both Dawkins and Armstrong refer to the divine plan, if there was one, and they disagree on that, as cruel, callously prodigal, and wasteful. How do you account for those perceived aspects of creation?
Those are non-scientific terms. It is interesting that they have made science the mother of all disciplines, that science is the one that describes and prescribes everything for us. How does science prescribe what is evil? How does science prescribe what is good? And so their very terms of critique and castigation immediately leave the fold of what it is they are defending to go into a fold that they are borrowing from, which ought not to actually exist in such categorical terms. This, I think, is the being hoist on their own petard. They sort of create an abyss for themselves in the process. This is fascinating to me when I look at things like this, because, and it's something that goes on in your mind and mine as well. Which of us hasn't wrestled with the possibility at some time in our lives, all right, this is what I believe. I, for example, am a committed follower of Jesus Christ. Have I never thought of the possibility that I could be wrong? Have I never engaged in a dialogue with myself as to what I believe? And then I move over to the side of the counter perspective and I just find it ground on which I cannot stand. So the weapons of their warfare, they use to decimate a worldview, but the weapons they borrow from are the worldview which actually doesn't exist. So they go for the linchpin right from the beginning, but in effect they end up strangling themselves in the process.
Armstrong refers to the God beyond God, is what she calls him, as a spiritual exercise akin to poetry. Well, certainly there is that aspect of the spiritual, but is that all it is?
These are the constructs that are created, a little bit like if you go back to the critique of the scriptures from the German theologians and the high critical theorists of the 19th century, moving on to the 20th, you know, that the Gospels came from maybe a document called Q, but there is no Q to present. So when they don't know how to sustain the basis of their argumentation, they manufacture an entity or a quantity from which to borrow the critique, and then they actually end up establishing that which is non-existent except for the case of reference. So the God beyond God, what does that mean? Are they talking about a person? No. Karen Armstrong will go on to talk about a symbol. But so to borrow from poetry, which is a way of communication and an art form of communication, she ends up borrowing from that as a construct for God himself. Fascinating. And we can deal with this a little more as to how her whole House of Cards words, collapses and implodes under its own weight. She's an interesting person. When you look back upon her own life and starting out in her younger years to become a nun and then walking away from that order in her undergraduate days, leaving quite a few thoughts actually and pursuits incomplete, and then going to Jerusalem and finding some kind of aesthetic union between the world religions, my goodness, the very fact of what's happening in Jerusalem ought to tell her there is no common ground in the basics of the belief there except the deductions of those beliefs to which she cannot lay any claim. So on the one hand, wrote a sympathetic article on Islam, but then her basic ethic is compassion, borrowing it from Buddhism, which is actually atheistic. It's such a hodgepodge of ideas that if you actually had to systematize it, it would defy strained credulity.
She, of course, brings up the issue of pain, something you hear constantly when you're out on the road talking to groups. And she asks bluntly, what of the pain and waste that Darwin unveiled? How do you answer her?
You can take pain as either a symptom of something deeper or an end in itself. And if you take pain as an end in itself, there is no imperative for what good actually means. Good could mean killing. Good could mean destroying. I mean, after all, if a baby is in pain and there's no solution and pain is the ultimate bad thing to experience, why allow that child to live unless pain is transcended by something greater than itself? And I think you're right that the whole idea of Darwin sort of unmasking this and revealing all of this, she really doesn't come to any answers in it. I think what she's telling us is, this to me is a problem with theism. Therefore, I have to find ways of dancing around this and finding solutions to human misery, which is where she gets off, by the way, in her charter, you know, to alleviate suffering, to take care of the poor and all of this, which is fascinating because in Isaiah 61, when Jesus went into the synagogue for the first time to read the scroll, he read from Isaiah 61 to bind up the brokenhearted, to those and to release those who are in prison, and all of this, but it was in keeping with the proclamation of the year of the Lord, and today this scripture is fulfilled in your ears. He brought to us the answer of God to the problem of pain, not as an arid, abstract idea of compassion, but rooted in the essential nature of God and the essential value of human life. That's why we deal with pain, not because pain is an abstraction, but it is a personal thing and persons have value.
She said something that did surprise me a little bit. She wrote that evolution has shaken the faith of many fundamentalist Christians to their core. Why do you suppose she singled out that group in that comment?
What does she mean by that term? Does she think that only those who are political activists are fundamentalists? Does she not think there's any such thing as the fundamentals of the Christian faith, just like Dawkins is a fundamentalist in his naturalism, that there is no room for anything spiritual? Why aren't they fundamentalists? If anybody should be called fundamentalists, it's them. In fact, they should be called reductionists rather than even fundamentalists. Now, is she saying something that has a tinge of truth to it? Are there those for whom their faith is shaken? Yeah, but I don't know if I'd brand them as fundamentalists. And in fact, if anything, fundamentalists sometimes, if in her terms, would be radical and overreacting in the other way and wanting textbooks burned and all this kinds of thing. Don't bring science into the classroom, pure sciences or behavioral sciences or anything like this. They don't want ontology or phenomenology. Get away from all of these things. Just teach fundamental Christian doctrine and so on. But if she means that thinking university students who would have left home believing in God and having sat in a church where the gospel was proclaimed and Genesis 1-3 was preached in a way that they took certain deductions from it to walk away and then say, this is all fully explained here comprehensively. Every word is taken in a literal interpretation. For them, as they walked into the science halls, their faith would have been challenged, would have been shaken, because after all, it's the starting point. What she doesn't deal with is the unanswered questions of naturalism. There are many scientists I know whose faith is also shaken in science in its dryness. People like Anthony Flew more recently and Ian Wilson more recently, hardly fundamentalists of any sort in the Christian sense, but very, very robust thinkers who are saying the metaphysics of atheism, or somebody like David Berlinsky, who's a scientist, saying the extensions of a naturalism are very illegitimately deduced here. And by the way, that's why some atheistic thinkers like Michael Ruse and all actually want to disassociate themselves with people like Dawkins and so on. Ruse's comment was, you're giving us atheists a bad name. And one of his comments was that they have not really treated religions fairly. And I think Karen Armstrong is guilty of identically the same thing, albeit espousing to herself the description of a theologian and certainly a history of the idea of God and so on.
Well, let's turn to what Dawkins had to say, and somewhat predictable, as I can imagine you would guess. Dawkins asks, what is so special about life? It never violates the laws of physics. Is there anything special about life?
This is so fascinating when Dawkins says something like this, that it never violates the laws of physics. My goodness. You know, the fundamental law of physics is this, that nothing physical in this world explains its own existence. No matter how you section physical, concrete reality, it will never explain its own existence. Certainly it hasn't hitherto. So you have to go beyond something physical as far as our scientific knowledge goes to explain how it brought itself into being, which certainly by extension one must at least at this point deduce that if something can explain its own existence at this point in empirical investigation, it would have to be something non-physical. And we also know, for example, that you never see intelligibility without intelligence. You will never assume a dictionary developed because of an explosion in a printing press, no matter how loudly you shout, because it is not just the collation of the raw data. It is the raw data itself that makes it possible to collate in this way, which speaks for an argument to design, not just from design. So when you take the argument of something coming from nothing, you take the argument of taking intelligibility without intelligence, you take the argument of personality coming from non-personality, you take the idea of values coming from non-values, the God of the gaps has shifted positions, actually. They've got some huge gaps they are unable to cross. So to say, everything that will ultimately be explained will be explained by physics is itself not a statement about physics. It is a philosophical statement. That's why people like Berlinsky say this is nothing more than a single vision that seeks to dominate the world in its thinking. And if you read people like Samuel Harris and so on, or if you go back into the 40s and read Huxley, you begin to see they don't want this world to have meaning. As Huxley said, that if the world actually had some meaning on the basis of a higher power, I would have to change my own moral beliefs and it would take me away from my sexual freedoms and so on. And Harris goes after the Christian for bringing moral values into sexual freedom and so on, that it has taken away from us. Get these people out. David Berlinsky's idea is they don't want to give the place for God in any way, quoting one of the geneticists, he said, we don't want God's foot in the door. And Berlinsky's idea is, for goodness sake, but what if the whole torso is wedged in the door and is pleading to be let in? So I think this is nothing more than a tendentious, extreme way of arguing, but it's what gets journalistic attention. If you are sounding very moderate, it's really not very popular.
I think it's interesting that Dawkins almost makes the universe appear to rise to the level of a deity when he writes, he's playing off the writings of Reverend William Paley, who called the universe of life God's greatest work. Dawkins writes instead, evolution is the universe's greatest work. Is he doing that?
Well, it's once again, you know, giving rational thought to a predicate without a subject. You know, this is such a marvelous escape of having your cake and eating it at the same time. Yes, we have this sense of wonder. We have this sense of awe. For whom? You don't actually sit down in front of a wall and say how beautiful you are. You still are superior to the object that you are adulating because the object is not returning the compliment. So it is a very subtle way of actually playing God while supposedly deifying the object of your worship. You are still, well, as he says, you're the best show on earth. What Dawkins doesn't tell you, who is the man who's going to be the measure of all of this? Since the universe is not going to tell you that, somebody has to tell you that. And this is a very stranglehold they come to. What is the way to live? Is it the way of Mother Teresa? Is it the way of Hugh Hefner? You know, even as you and I talk, one leading talk show host who was loud and vociferous and castigating the daughter of a previous political candidate, you know, for slipping up and getting impregnated while she was still so young, mocking her, ridiculing her in national television. Now you find out his own duplicitous life behind the scenes. And what is it? Another comedic release. But the world can see through, as they say, hypocrisy is the complement vice based to virtue. So I think this whole idea of saying the universe is worthy of our adulation, that we can worship, it is a devious form of self-worship. That's what it is. But he will never tell you which self. If you disagree with him, you're the buffoon, and he's the one with superior intelligence.
Well, Dawkins closes by saying, evolution is God's redundancy notice, his pink slip. God is not dead. He was never alive in the first place.
Yeah, which is, of course, the way he has to end up. The fact of the matter is, no matter how many pink slips they want to give to God, as someone said, he always rises up to outlive his pallbearers. They are ignoring some of the solid arguments. I have yet to hear a single atheist give me a definition of good. They all can recognize evil. They will all tell you why we should be good, but there's not a single definition of what good is. I'm not saying they're not good. I'm not saying they cannot choose to be good. But what is good? Is it a pragmatic definition? Is it a relativistic definition? Is it an absolutist definition? Isn't it interesting? When naturalism and materialism and secularism and relativism are holding sway, we are at the worst time in human history in terms of massacring each other. And I just think of the extraordinary toll we are taking on the unborn at this stage, all in the name of humanism. And the reason is they've never really even defined what it means to be human. This is nothing more than stark rebellion masquerading as sophistication. Muggeridge was right. He said we've educated ourselves into imbecility.
For Christians who read these essays and may have walked away saying, I don't know what I'm believing now, how would you counsel them?
Well, first of all, I think we need to alert our schools and our families and our theological institutions to respond to issues like this. In our own Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics at Oxford, where we have scientists like John Lennox and others like Alistair McGrath and all who've done major work in molecular biology and all these disciplines and theologians, one of the most popular courses we teach there is on the relationship between faith and reason, between science and belief. I mean, John Lennox has a triple doctorate. He's a scientist. He teaches pure mathematics. He's got a doctorate in philosophy, has debated Dawkins many times. So what I would say is the way we, first of all, it is wonderful to see the reaction. Almost every letter to the editor said, this is utterly bizarre what you have presented as man versus God. It really should have been man versus man. And that's about the way it should have been. But on the other hand, we need to learn how to respond to this, how to answer this, how to teach our young people, both in our churches and in our homes as we start out, and then where the academies with the Judeo-Christian worldview are teaching, to give due respect to what is being said, but then see how it implodes under its own weight of reasoning. The fact of the matter is this, people mount arguments. There are good arguments on both sides. But for one side to turn around like the atheist and saying this is God's pink slip time is so extreme and so nonsensical that that's why I think David Berlinsky's book and so on, in response to people like Dawkins, they're very powerful responses to people like him who say you are doing nothing but playing word games and recontouring disciplines. You know, Michael Polanyi, the famous philosopher or scientist, wrote a book many, many years ago on human knowledge. I remember reading it when I was at Cambridge. I think Polanyi was a scholar from there, spent 14 years of his life, maybe from Manchester, on the role of science, the nature of science, the philosophy of science, and science's boundary lines. He warned the scientist not to do precisely what people like Dawkins are doing. A person like Polanyi, you have high respect for. A person like Dawkins, you believe he has an agenda.
Robbie, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
If you'd like to order a copy of today's Q&A with Robbie, visit our online store at www.rzim.org. Look for the store tab and then the title of this message, Man vs. God.
Have you ever been put in the uncomfortable position of giving reasons for your faith? If you're a college student, there's a good chance a professor has ridiculed your beliefs in front of the entire class, posing difficult questions that you had trouble answering. Hi, I'm Nathan Zacharias, and I host an RZIM interactive youth apologetic series called Ask. Ask is divided into four sections: origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. And the reason we're looking at these four topics is because every worldview must answer them. Where do we come from? Origin. Why are we here? Meaning. What's right and what's wrong? Morality. And where are we going? Our destiny. Whether you're in class or just talking to your friends about serious questions, part of what we want to do with this series is give you a better idea of how to answer somebody who asks you tough questions about your beliefs. We created Ask to show the importance of forming a worldview that actually makes sense and matches reality. A worldview is just that. It's a way of viewing the world, a complete way of looking at life and coming to terms with why things are the way they are. So ask, because your questions matter. You'll find Ask online at www.rzim.org.
From the entire team at RZIM, I'm Bob Dittmer. Thanks for joining us. Let My People Think is a listener-supported radio ministry and a production of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Atlanta, Georgia.